from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
So we've really seen a huge shift in who makes up the media, and I think that that has really resulted in not just what they're covering, but how Americans feel about the media, which is not very good.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Batya Ungar Sargon, deputy opinion editor of Newsweek, and also author of the new book, Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. We'll talk at length with Batya about her new book a little bit later on in today's program. But first, talking now about the launch of the Nimrod Education Center here at Hillsdale College, and joined by three gentlemen. Al Stewart, who's the director of the Nimrod Education Center here at Hillsdale, Alan Taylor, who is the chair of the Nimrod Society, and also we're joined by Bob Rudosi, who is a member of the board of directors of the Nimrod Society. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Good to be here.
Thanks for having us.
And we'll start with Al first. Al Stewart, who is the director of the Nimrod Education Center. This is a new effort being launched here at Hillsdale College. Tell our listeners a little bit about what this is all about.
Yeah, the Nimrod Education Center is in place here at the college, and our goal, our mission is to help inform the non-hunting public and public overall about the contributions that hunters, anglers, recreational shooters provide to funding conservation in this country, and are really the leaders in why we have had restoration of so many species since, you know, the 1900s.
What's your background, and how do you see your role developing with the Nimrod Education Center?
Well, I've spent over 50 years as a wildlife biologist with the Michigan Department of Natural Resources, and recently retired, and was honored to have the college ask me if I was interested in being the director of this program. And so, in essence, I've spent 50 years practicing to get to this point, and I'm excited to be part of the program. And from here on, you know, we're going to engage students, we're going to engage public, it's a national program. So it's really the only one of its type that's attached to a college or a university with this very specific mission. And we're setting out to make a difference in a place that is really needs more communication on what's happening.
Alan Taylor is the chair of the Nimrod Society and co-founder, who is, of course, involved in the Nimrod Education Center here as well. Tell us your story and how the Nimrod Society came to be.
Well, I recognized for quite some time that the general public did not have a firm or clear idea of the involvement and importance of sportsmen here in the country and their role in both protecting and conserving of wildlife, and the general public that just did not have a clear understanding of how wildlife is managed and protected in this country.
And this effort with Hillsdale to create and launch the Nimrod Education Center, why Hillsdale College, and how do you see this education center operating here on campus and then radiating across the country?
Well, Hillsdale is an education center, and we're in the education business, so it was a natural partnership because Hillsdale has association with the shooting sports community. And, of course, conservationists, a big portion of it is with shooting sports, but it also includes fishermen. They showed an interest in it, in participating in further education of their students that eventually will disseminate across the country and continue with the message and support conservation through consumptive sportsmen efforts.
You mentioned, you know, the importance of public awareness when it comes to wildlife management, when it comes to conservation. What is this effort trying to counter? Why is there a need for this in the country?
Well, we've known for a long time that there are people that don't understand conservation can be supported by consumptive use of wildlife. And those people are out actively attempting to educate the public as to their views, which I believe are misguided. They don't have an understanding of wildlife protection and conservation. So this is our effort to tell the other side of the story.
Bob Berdosi is also with us, member of the board of directors for the Nimrod Society. And Bob, this is an opportunity for outreach with people hearing it across the country. If you could, you know, bullet point, what are the most important things that the Nimrod Society wants the public to know about these wildlife management conservation efforts, the model that sort of the Nimrod Society wants to work on?
Okay, there you go. That's a challenge. well, as far as we've touched on them and try to make them specific, I think one of the most important things is just making sure the public has actual factual data, real honest data, not emotionally slanted data mm-hmm. or tainted data about the wildlife resources that we have. That's important. So that they have an appreciation. Everyone likes wildlife, but they don't necessarily have real facts about it. And those facts get slanted sometimes, for political reasons and such. But, so making sure that they have factual information on a regular basis, I think another point would be to, what we found out is a lot of people don't realize one of the weaknesses is that most people don't know how wildlife management is funded.
Mm-hmm.
We discovered that early on. And many, many actual hunters and anglers don't even realize that the majority of wildlife management is funded through the license dollars that sportsmen spend, as well as, you know, other funds through Pittman Roberts and things like that. So educating the public about where the funding comes from. The average public believes that their tax money actually mm-hmm. funds for wildlife management. So it's mostly, I think it's just a continued outreach. We hope that with this evolution of the Nimrod Education Center, you were talking about, you know, where do we go? That's, I think, probably one of the challenges for mm-hmm. the program is what else can we do? We've got a couple models of state wildlife councils for
right.
communication, but, you know, what else might be possible?
Let's swing back over here to Al Stewart to sort of wrap things up here. Al is the director of the Nimrod Education Center here at Hillsdale College. Part of this has to do with the John Halter Shooting Sports Center that Hillsdale College has on campus and this partnership that Hillsdale has with USA Shooting as well. How does that work into the equation?
Every time you fire a shotgun shell, part of the revenue from that goes into wildlife conservation. And so without shooting, you wouldn't have conservation, and without conservation, you wouldn't have wildlife. And that's really, you know, a direct lead. Hillsdale College is very special because of the Halter Shooting Facility, but USA Olympic Shooting saw the uniqueness of this college and moved their home site for all USA Shooting here.
Hmm.
That spinoff then is many of these Olympic shooters or hunters,
mm-hmm.
or anglers, and what better individuals to have than these folks that represent our country to share this message that hunting and fishing is a legitimate use of the resources, and all of that goes into then to managing the wildlife
mm-hmm.
that we all appreciate as part of our personal quality of life. That's what this is all about.
Yep.
And Hillsdale College and the Nimrod Education Center right now is right in the middle of that. And, you know, as Bob and Al said, we're going to help share this message and network throughout the country on making sure people understand how conservation is funded.
Well, we look forward to seeing the Nimrod Education Center launch and grow. Al Stewart, director of the Nimrod Education Center, Alan Taylor, chairman of the Nimrod Society, and Bob Berdosi, member of the board at the Nimrod Society. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Up next, we talk with Batya Ungar Sargon. Her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're back on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. Find out more about Hillsdale College at hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Batya Ungar-Sargon, and her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Her day job, you find her at Newsweek, where she is Deputy Opinion Editor. Batya, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why? Explain to our listeners, why is journalism referred to as the fourth estate, and why, and this goes back to our founding fathers, of course, why is journalism so important for a democracy?
Wow, what great questions. The fourth estate was in reference to the other estates back in Europe in the day. So you had the priestly estate, which was the first estate, the noble estate was the second estate, and the third estate was the middle class. And then it was very, very important that there be a separate form of expression, expertise, authority to reflect upon the other forms of authority in the republic. That was considered to be a really important way of giving power to the people, that there was an independent source of authority that could explain to them what was happening in the other sources of authority, how power was being wielded by those who had it, so that they could then make up their minds and have a modicum of power through that knowledge. And so we can see why that's really, really important, right? You can look around yourself at your local government and think about what they would get up to if there was nobody reflecting on them, right? What people in power could do when there's no countervailing force to their authority that's informed by the facts in an independent way, right?
Mm-hmm. Your third chapter, A Status Revolution, begins by saying, even up until very recently, journalists were not part of the American elite. I would imagine most Americans now look at journalists, certainly those who cover our national politics, as being part of the elite. How did journalism start in this country? How did it transform into something that is controlled by the elite by and large?
So they're not wrong when people look around at the American journalists and think that they are part of the elite. They, in fact, are now part of the elite. Just from a purely economic point of view, journalists are now part of the top 10% in terms of income. But that actually took a lot of time. There was a status revolution among journalists that landed them there, and that status revolution took about 100 years. And what happened with that status revolution was journalists became increasingly highly educated, and the highly educated in America, we've seen over the last 20 years especially, how the economy today is really very heavily weighted in the favor of people who have a very, very elite degree, a very elite education. And so journalists today now are much more highly educated than the average American. They make a lot more money. They're much more coastal. 75% of all journalism jobs are on the coast. Another survey from 2017 found that the majority of journalists didn't just live in, you know, Clinton districts and in blue areas that went for Clinton, but they lived in the most pro-Clinton districts, right? So we've really seen a huge shift in who makes up the media. And I think that that has really resulted in not just what they're covering, but how Americans feel about the media, which is not very good.
Talking with Batya Ungar-Sargon, her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. It's impossible to underplay the role that the Internet has played on journalism. In some ways, did it break journalism when we look at some of the more elite establishments, read New York Times, Washington Post, etc., but also save journalism because of what independent writers and reporters now have access to and can do by themselves on the Internet? Did it both break and save journalism at the same time?
I mean, what a great question. It even saved, right, the New York Times, right? Like,
yes,
the places that
right.
We criticize for having lost their way because of the way that they responded to the digital pressures are also doing extremely well, right? Of course, thanks to digital journalism, thanks to Donald Trump, thanks to a host of factors, right? But yes, I could not agree with you more. You know, I think that when the Internet first came around, we all sort of imagined it would be this great democratizing force, right? It now essentially costs zero money to start a publication, right? So what could be more democratizing than that? But what happened was you have all of these legacy media outlets which have been leaning into both the pressures but also the opportunities of digital journalism. And what they have done with that is really lean into a very affluent, highly educated liberal audience as opposed to doing what, you know, Benjamin Dan Joseph Pulitzer did, which is say, you know, oh, wow, you know, we can do this for so much cheaper. Let's try to cater to a mass audience. And the reason that happened was because with digital media, and I tell you this as somebody who works in it, you can track everything, okay? You know who is reading your piece. You know where they live. You know how much money they make. You know what they bought yesterday and what they're going to buy tomorrow. You know what their political preferences are. You know what they like to eat. You know how long they stay on the page. You know what words make them click.
Right.
Right? This is, all of this information has been a boon for publications because now what they can do is say, oh, I can limit my audience by covering this topic and that topic to only, you know, very, very affluent, highly educated people.
Talking with Batya Ungar-Sargon, her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. I wanted to ask about woke media. I think most of our listeners have a pretty decent understanding of what you mean when you use that term, but why is it a danger? Why is it not just bad journalism? Why is it not just bad media? Why is it a problem for the country? And as you say in the title, why is it undermining democracy?
I argue in my book that journalists, as they underwent this status revolution and ascended to the American elite, that they abandoned the working class, they abandoned labor, they abandoned the sort of the masses who this nation is sort of built on, whose labor this nation is built on, who have been increasingly abandoned by both parties. And I argue that this is hugely problematic and hugely dangerous to our democracy. Journalists are using a moral panic around race to hide a huge class divide in America that's separating out people with a college education from people who don't have a college education. And at a time when the economy is really working very, very well for highly educated people and very, very poorly for people who don't have a college education.
The moral panic chapter, Batya, is it a problem that so many issues these days become nationalized? There is very little that remains local, and that sort of feeds into this social media hive that something that happens in Podunk, Missouri, isn't just an issue for that town anymore. It now becomes a national outrage. Is that healthy?
Oh, I think it's terrible. I mean, I have to admit something to you, but, you know, it's a funny thing for a journalist to admit, but I think people are reading too much journalism. Mm-hmm. I mean, people are too invested in the minutia of national politics. You know, the last 3 months, the Democrats have been negotiating their Build Back Better bill, right? This bill is going to pass in some form or another. Why does the entire nation have to be in on every single day? Who is the villain of today?
Mm-hmm.
What did Sanders get? What did Pramila Jayapal say? What did Sinema do? Who cares? You know, like, it's just, we've replaced spirituality and community with information and politics and knowledge that's totally nationalized and totally divorced from our lives. And it's not like the media is covering important things. Like, there's like a huge, huge revolution of workers underway right now that you cannot read about in any media outlet. Workers are standing up for themselves, demanding better wages. They are demanding better pay. They're demanding better benefits. A lot of them don't want the vaccine. You know, like, nobody is speaking up for these people. Nobody is representing them. Nothing that actually matters to our lives is being filtered through the media. But the agenda is being set because of this disproportionate amount of attention that we give to it.
Batya Ungar-Sargon, her new book is Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Batya, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Up next, we're joined by Elizabeth Fredericks from Hillsdale's English Department as we begin an occasional series on modern Irish poetry. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
North State Now is a magazine formatted show at 6 p.m. every Thursday night. The first Thursday is yours truly, Linda Bott, featuring what's going on in our town. The second Thursday is hosted by Michelle Slade, featuring heroes of the North State. The third Thursday is hosted by none other than James Masada and Rhonda Alvey from Enjoy the Magazine and Enjoy the Store. Our newest edition is the fourth Thursday of the month, Women of Vision. That's North State Now, Thursday at 6 p.m., also streaming on KCNR 1460.com, a jewel of the North State, a place we love to go and love being members.
The view, the best in the North State, from the restaurants, meeting rooms, and of course on the award-winning 18-hole golf course, Riverview Golf and Country Club. It's the place to belong.
Go in and meet the friendly staff today or go to their website at riverviewgolf.net and find out about their introductory memberships.
Riverview Golf and Country Club, corporate, social, tennis, fitness, and golf. Get it all. Become a member.
It's affordable and fun. Riverview Golf and Country Club.
Hi, this is Brian Martin, General Manager of River Commons Senior Living. One of the most rewarding things about what I do is watching the positive transformation that often occurs when a senior moves here to our beautiful, independent retirement community. Seniors can become isolated, find it hard to eat good, healthy meals, and even just get around. I call this a failure to thrive. At River Commons, we solve those challenges. You are surrounded by friendly people with similar life experiences. Chef Shalisa and her crew provide three delicious and healthy meals daily. Activities Director Ernie always has a wide variety of things to do, from arts and crafts to outings on our 25-passenger bus. Plus, we provide utilities, cable TV, scheduled transportation, weekly housekeeping, and more. We see seniors go from survive to thrive, and that is just a wonderful thing. Call today for a tour or luncheon a tour and experience River Commons for yourself. 221-2121 or on the web river-commons.com.
Join Aaron Ryan and Bill Cundiff for We the People Radio every Sunday from noon until 2. Our expert guests will give you the whole story rather than a bunch of sound bites. Our commercial-free archives are always available at wethepeopleradio.us.
Sponsored in part by Pape Machinery, located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard, for all your local John Deere ag and turf products. Join us every Sunday from noon until 2, wethepeopleradio.us.
What shall we do about them?
Have you been putting off getting your colonoscopy due to COVID restrictions? Well, there's no better time than now. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, colorectal cancer screenings have declined by 86%, and as a result, up to 10,000 more deaths are projected over the next decade. With early detection, colon cancer has a 90% survival rate, and it may even be preventable with a colonoscopy. At Reading Endoscopy Center, our number one priority is the health and safety of our patients, and our center has always been committed to maintaining strict infection control and prevention protocols. Schedule your colonoscopy today by calling us at 530-246-7000 or visiting readingendoscopy.com. Visit readingendoscopy.com.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Go to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address, radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We're joined now by Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks, Assistant Professor of English at Hillsdale College. Dr. Fredericks, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
We are excited to start a series with you today that will continue over the next couple of months. And we'll title this Modern Irish Poetry. And we'll begin with an introduction and look at some specific authors along the way as well. What separates Irish poetry from English poetry or any other European poetry for that matter?
Yeah, so there's a few elements. And, of course, the Irish tradition is often sometimes lumped in with the English tradition because it's all English language poetry. But understandably, Irish writers feel a strong tension about this and are often like very conscious of differentiating themselves from the English tradition. But there are a few things that are really striking about Irish poetry in general in relation to English poetry. One is that Irish poetry remains overall very strongly formal, using both clear stanzaic structures and also rhyme, although they do tend to use rhyme with a pretty light, deft touch. If you read, for instance, Irish poetry that's come out just recently, you may not notice the rhyme really strongly on first reading. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of slant rhyme, inexact rhyme, to lend it sort of a still more very conversational feel. And yet when you dig into it, it is very structured, sort of careful formality to the poetry. Scholar Matthew Campbell has described it as a poetic scene that operates outside the Anglo-American experimental conservative neo-modernist formalist turf wars. While there is some investment in that, by and large, Irish poets love form and love rhyme and mm-hmm. often stick to that. They'll also use sometimes very difficult poetic forms as well. most famously, Leontia Flynn, who's a young Irish poet, or kind of mid-career Irish poet, in her elegy for Seamus Heaney, used in 11-line form, which is, as she said, very challenging. At one point, I remember her talking about the poem and saying she wasn't sure what she was thinking when she did it. But then she did it, and she was stuck with it, so she had to keep going. And it's a fantastic piece. I mean, a wonderful way of showing respect to authors who've come before, which I think is part of the attraction. It's a way of sort of standing yourself in a tradition. And also finding ways, especially when dealing with difficult subjects, to impose order upon them, or to offer a sense of partial closure to things that are still open-ended and ongoing.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a lot of Irish poets do feel a strong sense of European identity as opposed to feeling close to British identity. Ireland is still part of the EU, and that's to them very important. Alternately, some Irish poets have really strong ties to America, and so that can also be a kind of counter-influence to the British influence.
You gave us a few names there in that introduction. Who would you say are the prominent Irish poets that perhaps people may know? Perhaps we'll discuss some of them later on in this series. But who are the prominent names we should know from this from modern Irish poetry?
Yeah, so W.B. Yeats, of course, is always the giant that sort of hovers over everything else and is probably the one that people are most familiar with because he is just hugely popular and extremely good, obviously. But there's a variety of others. Before Yeats, for instance, you have the poet Thomas Moore, who was the friend and biographer of Lord Byron. He's also the one we can blame for the fact that we don't have Byron's autobiography. He burned it after Byron's death. But he was hugely popular in the 19th century because he wrote the poems of Irish melodies, which get referenced in a number of 19th century novels. These were poems that were set to music, kind of written to be set to music. Moore himself was not a composer, so he mostly used popular tunes or let people pick their own tunes to play them to, but they were meant to be sung. James Clarence Mangan is another vital 19th century voice who translated a lot of early bardic poetry from Ireland and kind of wrote in that bardic style. It's a very lofty, non-sentimental mode in contrast to Moore, who is very sentimental. Moving past Yeats on the other side, or overlapping with him a bit, you have Austin Clarke, who was a prominent Dublin poet, and also Patrick Kavanagh, who are both significant writers. Kavanagh especially, while he isn't very well known stateside at times, he's one of the most beloved poets in Ireland. And the Irish Times released a list of the favorite Irish poems, 100 favorite Irish poems. And it was really Kavanagh and Yeats dueling it for the most poems on the list, with Seamus Heaney probably in third.
Talking with Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks about modern Irish poetry. So we know some of the names. How would you describe some of the more prominent themes of modern Irish poetry?
Yeah, this can vary over time in terms of which ones sort of ebb and flow, especially as people are resisting to what they might see as caricatures of Irish culture in sort of the international light. But Irish poetry may, especially in the 19th and early 20th century, draw from the region's really rich folklore and mythic traditions. This includes just folklore that's sort of oral tales, stories of the fairies, popular ballads, myths and superstitions, but also the four great cycles of Irish mythology, which are known as the mythological cycle, the Ulster cycle, the Fenian cycle, and the historical cycle. And a lot of stories we do know of, say, like Cuchulain or famous people like that, come from these mythic cycles. And even now, authors still will play with them. Kieran Carson, towards the end of his poetic career, famously translated one of the episodes from this called The Tan, which is a big story about a cattle raid, essentially, but with mythic warriors and famous queens instead of just local robbers. So that's often some of it. You may also get treatments of the tragic love story of Deirdre and Naois, which is a really popular one, too. Also, Ireland has a really strong tradition of classical influences that predates both the Norman and the Tudor conquests, so there's a tendency to draw from Greek and Roman poets and playwrights as well. The Irish really see that as being part of their history and not something that was foisted on them by outside sources.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes in the effort to resist English influence, the classical tradition is something to turn to. Homer, Virgil, and often they really love the Greek tragedies as well.
Final question here for Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks on modern Irish poetry. Tell us a bit about the Celtic Revival and its influence on Irish poetry.
Yeah, so the Celtic Revival is really a mix of movements that begins in the 19th century. We often think most of the literary movement because that gives us people like Yeats and his sort of contemporaries that we see there. But more broadly, the mix of movements sought to reinvigorate interest in a sort of pre-conquest Irish culture. And so as a result, it was about the revival of the Irish language, which the English had done their best to sort of try and stamp out.
Mm-hmm.
Also, reinvigoration of interest in Irish sports, which has led to the fact that, that Gaelic football is now really, really popular in Ireland. If you've never seen a Gaelic football match, it's really fun to watch, actually. Sort of all the most exciting things about soccer, football, rugby, and even a little touch of like basketball at all teams at times. It's wild and really, really entertaining. So there's interest in all of this and fresh interest in sort of Irish peasant life as well, because that's sometimes seen as the most authentic version of Irish life, Irish mythology, things like that. Even Irish visual art from that time sort of reinvigorates the visual culture of Ireland. And so all of these things sort of begin in the 19th century, carry forward in the 20th century. And what this tends to mean for our understanding is a revival of interest in Irish subject matter in literature.
Mm-hmm.
And Yeats is often seen as our most visible figure who engages in that. But a lot of his engagement with this also rests on his association with Lady Gregory, who is a widowed aristocrat who lives kind of in the west of Ireland. Her estates are there. And she develops an interest in learning Irish. Even though she herself is of a Protestant background, she starts learning Irish and going around her estate and collecting folklore and fairy tales from the people who live there and sort of codifying them, because she thinks there's something really fascinating there that's worth preserving, worth capturing, and also especially worth disseminating.
Mm-hmm.
And she and Yeats have a really, really fruitful collaboration pretty much until her death. She remains a vital friend for him. And so for Yeats, we see this in his work, in his use of fairy tales and Irish folklore themes throughout, especially his first three books of poetry. It's also an effort of pushing back against caricatures of the Irish in British culture of the time. The Paddy is kind of a stereotypical comic figure in Irish, in British theater, and in British literature, the sort of drunken, sentimental fool of a character. And so the Irish literary revival is pointing out that Ireland has this rich culture. And they aren't just a bunch of sentimental drinkers, but they're people with stories and songs, and they aren't just, they are capable of great art, not just sort of disposable culture.
Hmm. Dr. Elizabeth Fredericks, as we begin our series on modern Irish poetry, the next time we talk, we will talk about Yeats. Dr. Fredericks, Assistant Professor of English at Hillsdale College, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so much.
Up next, an alumni spotlight. We talk with Howard Smith from the Hillsdale Class of 1968, honored at our 2021 Alumni Awards Banquet as a distinguished alumnus. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
If the American people ever allow private banks to control the issuance of their currency, first by inflation, then by deflation, the banks and the corporations that will grow up around them will deprive the people of all their property until their children wake up homeless on the continent their fathers conquered.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Revolution has started.
Sovereign Minds, now on Sundays, 10 to noon.
Premier, your friendly gold change. Premier in all we do.
Fall sometimes brings us smoke and ash. This is one of those years. And the health of you and your car is very important. At Premier Oil Change, our 30-point certified service will not only check the fluids in your vehicle, but will make sure to reach the areas that ash, soot, and smoke can tax, like your engine's air filter. We also check your in-cabin air filter to help the quality of air that your family breathes. This is all part of our comprehensive 30-point certified service. Services require no appointment. Wait in the comfort of your own car with free Wi-Fi and beverage. Don't forget about Premier Oil Change Rewards Program. You earn points for every dollar you spend. Add to that, free fluid top-offs. Now that's service. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com. Located in the Holiday Market Shopping Center or in Reading on Lake Boulevard next to Waterworks Park, or our newest location in Anderson, across from Roundtable Pizza. All three locations, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
Happy holidays from Reading Electric Utility, your community-owned electric utility for 100 years. On behalf of all REU employees, we are wishing you a safe and happy holiday season. Please remember, holiday safety starts with you. Never overload an extension cord or electrical circuit. Make sure extension cords and lights are rated for outdoor use. And remember never to expose electrical outlets or connections to rain. Reading Electric Utility has been honored to serve you in 2021 and wishes you and your family a happy and healthy new year.
At Shasta Regional Medical Group, we're focused on the health matters that matter to you, like having a primary care doctor you trust. Our physicians put patients first. They take the time to listen to your needs and concerns, and they provide the information you need to make good decisions about your own health. At Shasta Regional Medical Group, you have an integrated network of caregivers and specialists working to serve you in a compassionate, patient-centered environment. We're conveniently located right across the street from Shasta Regional Medical Center. To make an appointment, call Shasta Regional Medical Group today at 605-4260 or visit us online at ShastaRegionalMedicalGroup.com. Shasta Regional Medical Group. Your primary care is our primary concern.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We say hello to our new listeners on AM 1320, FM 101.3 WKAN in Kankakee, Illinois. Thanks for listening to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. We're joined now by Howard Smith. He's a 1968 graduate of Hillsdale College, also CEO and owner at Wilson Bohannon Lock Company in Marion, Ohio, and being honored at the 2021 Alumni Awards Banquet here at Hillsdale as a distinguished alumnus. Howard, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're back here on campus. You had mentioned off-air you were here for your 50th, but it's been a couple of years. What are your feelings as you come back to Hillsdale College's campus?
Didn't look like this when I was here, you know, 50-plus years ago, for sure. I mean, we had a student hut, Hillsdale Street, it was right beside Mock. And then while I was here, they built the student center, which is just where you are right now.
Mm-hmm.
But it's impressive. I mean, Hillsdale grows in everybody's mind, starting with the Imprimis, you know, that goes back so many years to where it's almost 5 million people subscribe free of charge to the Imprimis. Hillsdale just grows and grows and grows and is more impressive as time goes on. And as I travel business-wise around the country, and I tell people I'm a graduate, golly, I have never met a graduate, but I think so much of Hillsdale College. I get the Imprimis. I love what they stand for, the defender of the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and the religious freedoms in our country. And we realize 1844 mm-hmm. and what it was, the principles and inclusion of women and all sorts of minorities, all the things that Hillsdale stood for, it's even more important in our country today.
So tell us a bit about Wilson Bohannon Lock Company. I had read that it is now in its seventh generation at the company. What do you do, and what makes Wilson Bohannon unique?
Well, we started out in 1860 in Brooklyn, New York. My wife's great-great-grandfather, my wife was also a graduate. We met the third week in college, and we graduated together. She went on and got her master's at Ohio State, and I went on and spent 4 years in the United States Coast Guard. But going back, 1860, her great-great-grandfather and his son, Todd Wilson Bohannon, founded the padlock manufacturing company in his backyard in a shed behind his house. 1870, they built their first building. 1884, I mean, they started to have another facility, a foundry, and basically they sold to the railroads. There were many lock manufacturers back then. We are now in the seventh generation. We moved to Marion, Ohio. My wife's grandfather moved it there in 1926, and that's where almost be 100 years. We're about a 70-employee facility. We have all 10 acres of our original industrial park. We were 1 acre back in 1926. We now own all 10 acres, 4 buildings, and about 70 employees, about 40,000-square-foot facility, and we make brass-keyed padlocks. So if you want to find out about us, you know, we just go to padlocks.com.
The company has survived for quite a long time through good times and bad times. What have you learned in your time at Wilson Bohannon about being successful when perhaps others are struggling?
I think it's easy for anyone to realize that when times are good, everyone is successful. It's when times are tough that's the challenge. How do you face that adversity? We have a steelworkers is our union we have. Came in 1968. I started working at Wilson Bohannon in 1973, and I've been there almost 50 years. I've been the first started in the accounting department, and then the last 25 years as the CEO, president of the company. So, and times get tough. In the recession of 08 and 2000, price of material goes sky high. Through efficiencies and productivity improvements, we remained competitive. We compete with products made overseas in China and Mexico. So automation, productivity improvements, and then having a good respect for each other. And two most important words, I believe, in business today is communication. letting everybody know your visions and your aspirations, keeping everybody on the same page, all the arrows pointing in the same direction, and also love, respect for each other. Our top five officers at our company have over 180 years experience at Wolfson Bohannon Company. So we have loyalty, we have good workforce, we embrace high-end technology, and as our competitors slowly go by the wayside, there's only a few lock manufacturers left in America, and we're proud to be 100% American-made.
Howard Smith is with us, CEO, owner of Wilson Bohannon Lock Company, and distinguished alumni at this year's 2021 Alumni Awards Banquet here at Hillsdale. How do you go about building a culture of employees who are happy to be there, who want to contribute to the success of the company?
You teach each person with respect and dignity. You should have love in your heart. You follow the Christian tenets, as Hillsdale College taught me many years ago, and you work together. As I said, communication is the most important word, I think, in business today. And we just work as a team. We work as a consensus. We believe in each other. We all try to do what we possibly can to make the company successful. And we embrace technology. We're high-end. And we have some of the finest lock machines in the world. And we just I embrace technology. I love technology, automation, robots. We just did a cyber audit through Columbus State. And they said they had never seen a company of 70 employees have as much technology, have as much cybersecurity wrapped inside their four walls as we do. Hmm. So there's a reason why we've been successful, is because we continue to pour money back into our facility. Instead of a lot of families, that usually don't make it past the first or second generation, the third generation says, I'm just going to take the money and run. We always plow our money back into our facility and into our employees. We pay good wages, and we honor all the people that work for us.
Wilson Bohannon is located in Marion, Ohio, about 40 miles north of Columbus. It's not quite as remote as Hillsdale, but it's not part of a major metropolitan area. Is there something to that, and why have you stayed in Marion for these years?
We started in Brooklyn, New York in 1860. Started with the railroads. Turn of the century, the railroads started to consolidate. Today, there's only five major railroads left in this country. So we wanted to go. We embraced the turn of the century, and we looked at what our business we sold to were utilities and heavy industry. So we moved to Marion to be more centrally located. Most of America was basically based between the Mississippi and the East Coast. Okay, so Marion was a railroad hub. So a gentleman, Mr. Huber, came to Marion in the 1870s. And built quite an industry. And then Marion Power Shovel, he was one of the founders of Marion Power Shovel. So Marion is considered a double diamond, so that's how we move product. Hmm. We wanted to be centrally located, closer to utilities and heavy industry, and there was a Malba Casting Company in Marion. And so for those reasons, then my wife's grandfather, Wilson Mahannon Choi, came through on a troop train in World War I, stopped at a whistle stop there, canteen stop, and he remembered the friendliness of the people in Marion. So in 26, when he was looking to move, he thought about Marion. There's where we stayed since 1926, one location.
Let's talk a bit about your time here at Hillsdale, class of 1968. What did Hillsdale teach you about being a responsible citizen, and how have you applied those lessons perhaps with Wilson Bohannon?
I believe in giving back. I believe in the community commitment. Hillsdale, just all the things they stand for, the religious freedoms, the conservative values, the defending of the Constitution, and all those things I believe in, and I honor those, and I embrace them today. So Hillsdale gave me all the basic tools to be a business person today with honor and respect. So Hillsdale just continues to impress everyone across this country. So all those things that I learned here, I applied many more times from my experience at Hillsdale. I mean, just the socializing, being part of something, being part of the union policy board, and things like that, and the leadership workshop program. There were so many opportunities at Hillsdale presented themselves to me, so I took advantage of all those things and enjoyed them. So many of those things I incorporated in my life and also in my business world. Mm-hmm. And Hillsdale, the imprimis that reaches over 5 million people, business people I talk to all across America are very, very impressed with Hillsdale. Look around how this campus has grown and how your $1 billion you apply to students, where 90-some% of your students get some form of aid. Other universities, the Yales, the Harvards, that have $40 or $50 billion. Do they share that with their students? Certainly Hillsdale does.
Howard Smith, Hillsdale College Class of 1968, CEO, owner of Wilson Bohannon Lock Company out of Marion, Ohio. And that website, one more time, is?
Padlocks.com. Anywhere in the world you want to find about a padlock, is padlocks.com. And or if you want to buy Made in America, you'll go and you'll see us.
Howard, thanks so much for joining us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you so very much.
That will do it for this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Al Stewart and Alan Taylor telling us about the Nimrod Center here at Hillsdale College. Batya Ungar Sargon, her new book is called Bad News. Elizabeth Fredericks talked to us about modern Irish poetry. And we heard from honored Hillsdale alumnus Howard Smith. You can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including Batya Ungar Sargon this week, or listen anytime to the podcast. Find it at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow the show on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. The assistant producer of the show is Nate Esbenshade. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Fabulous fall specials going on now at High Noble Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane, also in Roseville and Petaluma. High Noble Safe Company has fireproof and waterproof safes. Protect your guns, cash and valuables, heirlooms and collectibles, and important documents. With delivery, moving and repair service available in Redding, Roseville and Petaluma. Call 530-223-5050. That's 530-223-5050 or stop by High Noble Safe Company at 2559 Larkspur Lane today.
Founded in 1995, GI Pathology is the only physician-owned laboratory in the United States dedicated solely to the practice of gastrointestinal and liver pathology. The company provides the highest quality GI pathology diagnosis made exclusively by one of our fellowship-trained gastrointestinal and liver pathologists. GI Pathology delivers results to its Northern California client base within an industry-leading 24 hours. Call 888-2-GI-PATH or go to www.gipath.com for more information.
Hi, this is Mark from Haven Humane Society. It has been a challenging couple of years, and through it all, our amazing team has continued to save lives. We have so many fantastic animals that are looking for their forever homes, and with adoption fees so low, now is the time to add to your family. With puppies, kittens, dogs, cats, and so many more, we have the perfect addition. Come join our team as a volunteer and help in an area that works for you. Walking dogs, socializing cats, helping in our veterinary hospital, or folding laundry. We have many opportunities and welcome all volunteers. For more information, please visit our website at havenhumane.org or follow us on Facebook. On behalf of the entire Haven team, thank you for all of your continued support as together we get closer every day to a North State with no more homeless.
This is RC with today's Cigar of the Month. Present with us is the Partagas Cortado. Wrapped in an elegant Ecuadorian Connecticut seed leaf, the bold 8-inch long Presidente is a soft smoke. Perfect with coffee after breakfast, the Partagas Cortado reaches sublime notes of creamy, spicy, and mineral-rich deliciousness. Get yours today at Tobacco & Brew, 2143 Hilltop, Redding, California.
Greetings to my fellow veterans. This is Senator Maurice Johannesson, former Secretary of Veterans Affairs for the state of California. I'm a Korean vet, and it's my honor to serve in the U.S. Army as a new immigrant to this great country. Thank you for your service. It will not be forgotten. It should be remembered that freedom is not free. It has been secured by brave sacrifice that all members of our military and their families have given since the beginning of a great, wonderful nation. Thank you for your service.
This holiday season, begin a whole new tradition of lights and festivities for the entire family at Redding Garden of Lights. Taking place November 19th through December 31st at Turtle Bay's Locano Botanical Gardens by the Sundial Bridge in Redding, California. Explore 10 acres of outdoor illuminated gardens featuring over 1 million lights, plus holiday-themed food, drinks, music, and so much more. Redding Garden of Lights, November 19th through December 31st, presented by Mercy Medical Center Redding. Learn more at turtlebay.org.
Colonoscopy is the most effective method of screening for colon cancer and is the only procedure that can both detect and prevent cancer in one procedure. Take-home tests can miss up to 1 in 12 of colon cancers and most precancerous polyps. If you're 50 or older, now is the time to schedule this life-saving test. When caught early, the survival rate of colon cancer is 90%, so stop making excuses and get screened. This public service message is brought to you by Reading Endoscopy Center. Call them at 530-246-7000 or visit readingendoscopy.com.
Very often we write down a sentence too early, then another too late.
What we have to do is to write it down at the proper time. Otherwise, it's lost. Thomas Bernard.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hull.
And I'm Lee Esses.
Happy NaNoWriMo!
Woo-woo!
We are the second day into November. I hope you've started your process to achieving your NaNoWriMo goals. To give you a little bit of motivation, we are doing a month-long giveaway.
You've heard us talk about the merchandise of Write Selfishly on a t-shirt and on mugs and that kind of thing.
Now on masks.
These will be what we're giving away at the end. We will do a drawing on our Facebook page.
So what you need to do to be entered into the giveaway is to like our Facebook page and then find one of us on NaNoWriMo website. We will include links to this on Facebook, on the landing page of this episode, and in the About Me section on our website.
And then every day that you hit your word goal, you'll be entered into this drawing for the end of the month.
Just send us a message on Nano saying, hey, I'm entering your giveaway, and we will keep an eye on the goals that you enter into the Nano website.
This is simply meant to be motivation to get you to be writing your book.
For me personally, Nano means a lot. I did the Camp July Nano, and that's what ended with me having a finished book. That's what ended with me having Toxic be able to release and publish. To help celebrate that, we are going to include copies of our books in this giveaway.
Our goal for this month is to give you kind of tricks of the trade, little things to keep in your arsenal when you're stuck. These little tricks will help you move your story forward. That is the purpose of this month. So the first thing we're talking about is writing right, right now. So, Lee, what is the biggest thing that holds you back from writing?
Perfectionism. When I hear the phrase writing right, right now, all I hear is writing right. I say I want it to be right the first time. I have to write it right the first time. And I don't track the right now part of it. Because when we say write it right, right now, we don't mean it has to be perfect right now. We mean just get it written right now.
When we are talking about your NaNoWriMo word count goals, we don't mean 1,667 perfect words. We mean 1,667 words that have been written. It's far more important to write it right now than to write it right.
Because there is no right way to write, especially on a first draft. Word vomit if you have to just get it on the page. And that is the first trick of the trade. Just write something. You also want to avoid asking yourself certain questions while you are writing.
And I know this from experience. I built this list because I've asked myself these questions so many times, and every time it grinds my writing process to a halt.
Question number one, does this make sense?
You are not writing selfishly if you're asking yourself that question. You are thinking about your audience during your first draft. Does it make sense to you enough to when you can look back on it and polish it later?
Fix it in post.
Another question that I find grinds me to a halt is, what is the perfect word for this moment?
Throw in a filler word that you wouldn't use anywhere else in the story. Throw in brackets. Throw in an excessive amount of asterisks. Something that you remember that you can control F, find, and change later, so you aren't getting stuck on one word. Do not let one word derail your train.
Yeah, just keep moving and trust the editing process. If you have an idea of what happens next, write it. Don't let anything stand in your way.
Another question is a question of, is this redundant or is this just completely out of the blue? Is this continuous? I don't know if that's a real word.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.